If he wanted to get hold of some exam papers, Chris would find a way to get them. A spot to stand in the fields to see into the girls' changing rooms. Chris could calculate the best vantage point. A way to break into the newsagents and steal sweets and fireworks. Chris could devise a plan to do it. If his skull hadn't smashed open in the schoolyard, and his brilliant brains spilt all over the stained grey concrete, Chris would have grown up to be a billionaire entrepreneur. Or a criminal mastermind. That's what I had always thought. When he blustered into the kids' playground that Friday evening, late as usual, because Chris was always late, not fashionably but red-faced, tie askew, food down his shirt and apologetically so, he was even more flushed and frantic than normal. Straight off, I knew something was up. All right, Chris.
The site. Found. Ground.
When nervous, Chris's stutter worsened. It became almost entirely incomprehensible. I glanced over at Hurst and Fletch. Marie wasn't with us that evening, as she had to help her mum with some chores, so there was just the three of us, killing time, talking shit. In a way, it was a good thing. As much as I liked Marie, well, that was the problem. I liked Marie. Too much. And when she was with us, she was with Hurst, his arm slung proprietorially around her shoulders. Now he dropped his half-smoked cigarette to the ground, jumped down from the climbing frame and regarded Chris in the hazy evening twilight.
All right, mate, calm down. Fuck's sake, you sound like a fucking speaking spell.
Fletch chortled like someone had just filled his cigarette with laughing gas. Chris's face flamed harder, cheeks fire engine red in his pale face. His hair was tousled and tufted like a particularly windswept haystack, and his sweatshirt was creased and crusted with dirt. But the thing I noticed most about him was his eyes. Always a startling blue, that night they blazed. Sometimes, though I didn't like to admit it because it made me sound a bit weird and gay, Chris looked like some kind of beautiful, crazed angel. Leave him, I said to Hurst. I was the only one who could get away with speaking to Hurst like that. He listened to me. I guess that was my use. I was his voice of reason. He trusted me. The fact that I often did his English homework for him didn't hurt either. I ground out my own cigarette. I never really liked them that much. Just like beer. The taste made me want to spit and wipe my tongue. Of course, I have grown older, wiser, and more addicted since then.
Breathe, I said to Chris. Speak slowly. Tell us.
Chris nodded and attempted to rein in his manic huffing and puffing. He clutched his hands together tightly in front of him, trying to get control over his nerves and his stutter.
Fucking retard,
Fletch muttered, and spat a huge gob of phlegm onto the ground. Hurst gave me a look. I reached into my pocket, pulled out a slightly melted wham bar, and held it out to Chris, like offering a treat to a puppy.
Here.
Contrary to what is believed nowadays, a sugary snack was about the only thing that could calm Chris down. Perhaps that's why he nearly always had a constant supply of them. Chris accepted the wham bar, chewed a bit, and then, still half-chewing, said,
Been up. Up at the old mine.
Okay.
All of us kids went up there and messed around sometimes. Before they started to demolish the old buildings, we would sneak in and nick stuff. Useless stuff. Bits of old metal and machinery. Just to prove we'd been. But Chris went up there a lot. On his own, which was odd. But then everything about Chris was odd, so much so that it just became normal after a while. When I asked him once why he went up there so much, he said,
I have to look.
For what?
I don't know yet.
Conversations with Chris could be frustrating. I fought my irritation down as he struggled to find his words without them breaking into pieces on his tongue. Finally, he said,
I found something. In the ground. could be a way in.
A way into what?
The pit.
I stared at him, and it was weird. I felt like I'd heard the words before, or had been expecting them. A strange shiver ran around my body, like when you touch a trolley and your hand tingles with static.
The pit.
Hurst loped over. You found a way into the old mine shafts.
Fucking ace,
Fletch added. I shook my head.
No way. They were all blocked off, and anyway, those shafts are like hundreds of feet down.
Hurst looked at me, then nodded. Thorny's right. Are you sure, Doughboy? Doughboy was Hurst's nickname for Chris, because he was soft as dough. Chris looked between us, helpless as a giant rabbit caught in our headlights. He swallowed and said,
I don't know for sure. I'll show you.
It was only later, when I really thought about it, and I had plenty of opportunity to think about it, that I realized he never answered Hurst's question.
A way into the old mine shafts.
We presumed that's what he meant. But I don't think he did, even then. He meant the pit. Like he already knew what it was. And the pit was something very different indeed. The light was losing its grip on the day by the time we got up there. It was late August, the tail end of the summer holidays, and the nights were drawing in, as my mum would say, which always made me think of someone taking a great big piece of charcoal and scribbling out the day. I think we all had that feeling of stuff ending, like you always do when you're a kid and 6 weeks of holiday is almost over. I guess we also knew that this was our last summer of really being kids. Next year we had exams, and plenty of our classmates, even in the 90s, would leave school straight for work, although not straight down the mine, like they used to. By this point, the old colliery site was just a great muddy scar on the landscape. Grass and scrubby bushes were starting to take a grip. But the place was mostly still black with coal dust, and littered with rocks, rusted machinery, sharp fragments of metal and lumps of concrete. We hauled ourselves through a gap in the ineffectual security fencing around the outside, where signs like danger, forbidden, and no trespassing might as well have read, welcome, come in, and dare you. Chris led the way. Well, sort of. He scrambled and slid and tripped, then stopped, looked around and scrambled and slid and tripped some more.
Fuck, Doughboy. You sure you're going the right way? Hurst panted. The old shafts are back that way.
Chris shook his head.
This way.
Hurst looked at me. I shrugged. Fletch made a whirling motion at the side of his head.
Give him a chance, I said.
We continued our awkward progress. At the peak of one steep, muddy summit, Chris paused and looked around for a long while, like a large dog sniffing the air. Then he plunged down the almost sheer incline, scrabbling and skidding through the gravel and rubble.
Fuck's sake, Fletch muttered. I'm not going down there.
I admit I was tempted to turn back, but I also felt a strange bubbling excitement. Like when you see a fairground ride, and you don't want to get on it because it looks scary as fuck, but another part of you does want to, really badly. I glanced at Fletch, and couldn't resist.
Scared?
He glared at me.
Fuck you!
Hurst grinned, never happier than when there was discord within the troops.
Pussies!
He cried. And then with a wild whoop, he plunged down the slope. I followed more cautiously. Fletch swore again, then did the same. At the bottom, I almost slipped on my ass, but just managed to keep my footing. I felt gravel lodge in my trainers and dig into the soles of my feet. Overhead, the sky seemed to hang lower, heavy with impending darkness.
We're not going to be able to see fuck all now, Fletch moaned.
How much further? Hurst asked.
We're there,
Chris called back, and disappeared. I blinked, looked around, then spotted a flash of grey. He was crouched down in a hollow formed by a small overhang. If you looked quickly, you wouldn't even see him in the dip. We scrambled down after him. Patchy grass and bushes had started to make a tentative hold on the ground nearby, offering further camouflage. There were several large rocks scattered around. Chris moved a couple, and I realized he had placed them there on purpose, as markers. He shoved away dirt and smaller stones with his hands. Then he sat back on his heels and stared at us triumphantly.
What?
Fletch spat in disgust.
I can't see nothing.
We all squinted at the uncovered patch of earth. Maybe a bit more uneven and a slightly different colour to the surrounding earth, but that was it.
Are you taking the piss, Doughboy? Hurst snarled.
He grabbed him by the neck of his sweatshirt. Because if this is some kind of wind-up... Chris's eyes widened.
No wind-up.
I would think later that, even then, half-choked by Hurst, he still didn't stutter. Not here. Wait, I said. I bent closer to the ground, brushed away a bit more dirt and felt my fingers touch something colder. Metal. I sat back, and suddenly I saw it. A circular shape in the earth, rusted almost the same colour, but not quite. It looked a bit like an old hubcap, but if you looked closer you could see it was too large for a hubcap, and too thick. There were small round lumps around the edge, like rivets. In the middle was another circle, slightly raised, with grooves in it.
There, I said. Can you see it now?
I pointed at the ground and looked back at the others. Hurst dropped Chris.
What the fuck is it?
It's just an old hubcap,
Fletch said, echoing my first thought.
Too big,
Hurst said immediately, echoing my second thought. He looked back at Chris.
Well?
Chris just stared at him, as if the answer was obvious.
It's a hatch.
A what?
It's like an opening, I said. To underground. Hurst's face broke into a wide grin.
Fucking ace!
He looked back at the circular shape in the ground.
So? What?
Some sort of escape shaft for the mines or something? I think I've heard of those. I never had, and my dad had worked down the mines most of his life, but I knew mines did have air shafts to ventilate them. I didn't see how that would help us much, though. Those shafts were the equivalent of chimney stacks. They ran all the way up to the surface, a drop of around 300 feet straight down. That wasn't a way in. That was suicide. I was about to point this out when Hurst spoke again.
Go on, then,
he said to Chris.
Open it!
Chris looked pained.
I can't.
You can't?
Hurst shook his head in disgust.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Doughboy.
He bent and tried to grasp the edges of the metal, wedging his fingers underneath. But it was so big and heavy I could see he was having difficulty getting any traction. He grunted and heaved, then yelled at the rest of us.
Well, come on, fucking help me, you bunch of twats!
Despite my trepidation, I complied, along with Fletch. We all dug our fingers into the dirt and tried to grasp the metal around the edges. But it was impossible. It was just too thick and too deeply embedded into the earth. It had probably been untouched for years. However much we pulled and twisted and tugged, it just wouldn't budge.
Fuck this,
Hurst gasped, and we all fell gratefully back onto the hard ground, arms aching, chests heaving. I looked back at the strange metal circle. Yes, it was stuck fast in the earth. But if it was some kind of smoke or escape hatch, surely there ought to be a handle or lever so you could get it up quickly if necessary. That was the whole point of a hatch. But there was nothing, except that odd second circle. almost as if it wasn't put there to be opened at all, not to let anyone in or out.
Right, Hurst said. We need to get some proper tools and get it up.
Now, I said. The light had faded so fast, I could only just make out the ghostly circles of their faces.
What's the matter? You wimping out, Thorny?
I bristled.
No, I'm just saying it's almost dark. We're not going to have much time. If we're going in, we should be prepared.
Not that I wanted to go in at all. If indeed there even was an inn to go to, but it seemed the best argument for now. I thought he was going to argue back. Then he said,
You're right. We'll come back tomorrow.
He looked around at us all.
We'll need torches, he grinned, and a crowbar.
We covered the hatch roughly with dirt and rocks, and then, as a marker, Hurst left his school tie in a loose knot on the ground. No one casually walking past would think anything of it. Ties, like trainers and socks, were often scattered around the old colliery site. Then, as the final trace of light withered from the sky, we started to trudge home. I'm not sure, but I think I glanced back once, a strange feeling of unease tickling the base of my neck. I couldn't have possibly seen anything from that distance, but in my mind I could still just make out the strange rusty hatch. I didn't like it. A crowbar. I didn't like that either.
17.
After Marie has gone, I can't settle. My leg is hurting again, and even the addition of a large bourbon and two codeine tablets can't ease the twitching nerves. Sitting makes it ache. Pacing makes it throb. I curse and rub at it viciously. I try to distract myself with a book, some music. Then I stand and smoke at the back door. Again. My mind is also working overtime. Suffocate the little children. Rest in pieces. It's happening again. The sender of the text must be the same person who sent me the email. And if they know about the angel, then they must have known me all those years ago. Not Hurst or Marie. Fletch? I'm not sure Fletch is capable of sending a coherent text message, not with the lack of opposable thumbs. So who else? And more to the point, why? My general state of befuddled confusion has not been helped by Marie's impromptu visit tonight. I'm not sure if I've done the right thing, if I have shown my hand too soon. A good gambler knows never to do that. Not without being damn certain what cards the other player is holding. But then, I don't have much time. Certainly not as much as I thought. Because Gloria is here. Waiting. Impatiently. Tapping those glittery red nails. If I don't satisfy her demands soon, the game will be over. Because I will be dead, quite possibly with no hands at all. Or feet. Or anything that could be used to identify my body. I chuck my cigarette out into the darkness and watch the glowing red tip dim and die. Then I turn, limp back into the kitchen, and take the folder out from beneath the sink. Because who am I kidding? I was always going to read it. And pour another drink, walk into the living room and place it on the coffee table in front of me. The twitching nerves in my leg aren't the only things that are restless tonight. I can feel the cottage shifting around me. The lights seem to ebb and dim occasionally. Nothing new with the village electricity supply. But I can hear something too. A noise. Familiar. Troubling. That same faint chittering sound. It makes my fillings hum. And the hairs on my skin bristle. Grating. External tinnitus. I wonder if Julia sat here and tried to tune out the same insidious noise, night after night. Or if it only came later. Chicken and egg. Did what happened to Ben somehow change the cottage? Or was the cottage already a part of it? The skittering in the walls and the creeping cold feeding Julia's fear and paranoia? I drag my hands through my hair and rub at my eyes. The chittering seems to have grown louder. I try to ignore it. I thumb through the folder until, once again, Annie's face beams out at me. Search for missing 8-year-old continues. The headline. But not the whole story. Not even close. Dad put her to bed that night. About 8. Or so he thought. He was drunk. As he was most evenings by then. Mum was at Nan and Grandad's house because Nan had had a nasty fall a few days before and broken her ankle and wrist. I was out with Hurst and his gang. It wasn't until the next morning that Mum discovered Annie wasn't in her bed, or her room, or anywhere in the house. The police were called. There were questions, searches. Uniformed officers and local men, including my dad, spread out in uneven lines across the old colliery site, and the fields beyond, hunch-shouldered against the pummeling rain, dressed in long black waterproofs that made them look like giant vultures. They trod slowly and wearily, as though in time to some somber internal beat, and brushed at the ground with branches and sticks. I wanted to go with them. I asked, begged, but a kind-faced officer with a beard and bald crown placed a hand on my shoulder and said gently, "I don't think that's a good idea, son. Best you stay here, help your mum." At the time, I was angry. Thought he was treating me like a child, a nuisance. Later I would realize he was trying to protect me from finding my sister's body. I could have told him it was too late to protect me. I could have told the police a lot of things, but nobody wanted to listen. I tried. I told them how sometimes Annie would follow me when I went out with my mates, sneak out of the house. I had brought her back before. They nodded and took notes, but it didn't really change anything. They knew Annie had sneaked out of the house. They just didn't know where she'd gone. The one thing I couldn't tell them was the truth. Not the whole truth. Because nobody would have believed me. I wasn't even sure I believed it myself. Every second, minute and hour that passed, the terror and guilt grew. I have never been more aware of what a coward I am than in the 48 hours that my sister was missing. Fear battled conscience, tearing up my insides. I'm not sure which would have won in the end if the impossible hadn't happened. I turned the page. Missing 8-year-old found. Parents' joy. I was in the kitchen making toast for Mum and Dad when Annie came back. The bread was stale and a bit mouldy. Nobody had gone shopping since last week. I scraped off the mould and stuck it under the grill. It didn't matter. They wouldn't eat it anyway. I would just end up throwing it in the bin with the previous day's uneaten meals. There was a knock at the door. We all looked up, but no one moved. 3 knocks. Did that mean news? We listened like it was Morse code. Knock, knock, knock. Good or bad? It was Mom who broke first. Maybe she was the bravest, or maybe she was just tired of waiting. She needed release, one way or another. She shoved her chair back and staggered to the door. Dad didn't move at all. I hovered in the hallway. I could smell the toast burning, but neither of us moved to take it off the grill. Mum pulled open the door. A policeman stood there. I couldn't hear what he was saying, but I saw Mum wilt and clutch the doorframe. My heart stuttered to a halt. I couldn't swallow. I couldn't breathe. And then she turned and screamed, "She's alive! They found her!
They found our baby.
We went to the police station together. Arnhill had its own back then. Squashed into the back of a blue and white police car. Mum and Dad wet-eyed with joy and relief, and me a sweating mass of jangling nerves. As we climbed out of the car, my legs gave, and Dad had to catch my arm.
"It's all right, son," he said. "It's going to be all right now."
I wanted to believe him, I really did. I used to think my dad was right about everything, always trusted his word. But even then I knew things weren't all right. Things would never be all right again. "She hasn't said very much," the officer told us as we walked down a long, pale corridor that smelled of sweat and urine. "Just her name, and she asked for a drink."
We all nodded.
"Did someone take her?"
Mum blurted out.
"Did someone hurt her?"
"We don't know. A dog walker found her wandering up on the old colliery site. She doesn't seem to have any physical injuries. She's just cold and a little dehydrated."
"Can we take her home?"
Dad asked. The officer nodded. "Yes, I think that would be best."
He held open the door to the interview room.
"Joe?"
Mum nudged me, and before I had a chance to gather myself or make sense of anything, we walked inside. Annie sat on a plastic chair next to a lady police officer who obviously didn't have much to do with children and looked awkward and uncomfortable. There was a small cup of squash on the table and some uneaten biscuits. Annie stared straight past them at the dirty, scuffed wall and swung her legs back and forth. Her pyjamas were muddy and torn in places. The police had wrapped her in a blue blanket that was too big and no doubt intended for the adult prisoners who normally frequented the cells. Her feet were bare and black with coal dust. She clutched something to her chest, half hidden by the blanket. I could just see dirty blonde curls, pink plastic, one blue eye. My scalp prickled. Abby eyes. She brought her back.
"Oh, Annie!"
Mum and Dad ran over and wrapped her in their arms. They smothered her in kisses, getting covered in dirt and coal dust themselves, but not caring because their daughter was back. Their little girl was home, safe and sound. Annie remained still, face impassive, only her legs swinging back and forth. Mum slowly drew away, her face tear-streaked. She reached out and smoothed a hand down Annie's cheek.
"What happened, sweetheart? What happened to you?"
I hovered by the door, hoping that the officers would mistake my reticence for teenage awkwardness. Perhaps I was even trying to convince myself it was the reason I hadn't moved any closer. Annie looked up. Her eyes found mine.
"Joey."
She smiled. And that was when I realized what was wrong. What was so terribly, horribly wrong. I stand. The closeness of memory feels suffocating, like it's choking me. I can taste bitter bile at the back of my throat. I stagger upstairs, making it to the bathroom just in time. I spew sour brown liquid into the stained sink. I pause, breathing raggedly, and then my stomach convulses again. More vomit forces its way out of my throat and down my nose. I clutch at the cold porcelain, trying to catch my breath and stop myself from shaking. I lean there for a while, waiting for my legs to regain some solidity, staring at the vomit-splattered basin. Eventually, I turn on the tap and wash the lumpy brown contents of my stomach down the plug hole. I spit a few times and breathe, slowly and deeply. The water from the sink gurgles noisily down the pipes. That's not all I can hear. Now I've finished vomiting, I'm conscious again of that invasive, chittering, skittering sound. Closer. Insistent. All around me. I shiver. The cold is back too. Creeping cold. I look over at the toilet. The brick still squats on top of it. I carefully lift it off, then reach for the plastic toilet brush and use the scraggy end to flip up the lid. I inch forward and peer inside. Empty. I look around. The shower curtain is closed. I grab the moldy edge and yank it to one side. The only thing lurking behind it is a scum of shower gel and a dirty sponge. I walk out of the bathroom. The chittering skittering seems to move with me. In the pipes, the walls. I advance along the landing, still brandishing the toilet brush. I glance into my bedroom. Nothing to see here. Something about this niggles at me. And then it's gone. I keep moving forward, towards Ben's room. There's a smell. Not a toilet brush. This smell is rich, metallic. I've smelled it before. Another house, another door. But the same feral scent. The same creeping cold, slithering through my guts like an icy parasite. I grip the handle. Then I push open the door and quickly flick the switch. The bare bulb spews out a jaundiced yellow light. I look around. It's not a big room. Just enough space for a single bed, a wardrobe, and one small chest of drawers. The room has been decorated. Several coats, I imagine. I see all of this, but I don't really see it. Because all I see is red. Soaking the new mattress. Running down the wall. Slippery ruby rivulets slithering down from the words painted there. Her writing. His blood. Not my son. When did she decide? When did she realize? Was it a slow accumulation? The horror and dread building every minute, every hour, every day until she could no longer take it? The smell, the creeping cold, the noises. She already had the gun, but she didn't use the gun on Ben. She killed him with her bare hands, consumed by fear, rage. Or did something happen that left her with no other choice? I forced myself to close my eyes. When I opened them, the blood and words have gone. The walls are bare and clean, the same shade of bland off-white as the rest of the house. Malevolent magnolia. I give the room a final glance, then I back out and close the door. I rest my forehead against the wood, breathing deeply. Just the cottage. Just playing with your mind. I turn. My heart stops. Jesus. Abby Eyes sits on the carpet, halfway down the landing. Pudgy plastic legs poke out in front of her. Blonde curls stick out in disarray. Her wonky eye gazes off towards a dusty cobweb in the corner. The good blue eye stares up at me, mockingly.
Hey, Joey. I came back. Again.
I stare around, as if I might spot some cheeky doll-depositing burglar creeping down the stairs, giggling at his little joke. But no one is there. On unsteady legs, I walk over and pick Abby Eyes up. The loose eye rattles. Her cheap polyester dress rustles stiffly. The weight of her, the feel of the hard, cold plastic in my hand, makes my skin squirm. The urge to hurl her out of a window into the overgrown back garden is almost overwhelming, but I'm seized by an even more unpleasant image of her crawling back to the house, her plastic, rosy-cheeked face pressed to the glass, peering in from the darkness. Instead, holding her at arm's length like an unexploded bomb, I walk back down the stairs and into the kitchen. I open the cupboard under the sink, stuff her inside, along with the toilet brush, and slam the door shut. Shit. My whole body is shaking. I'm not sure if I'm about to faint or about to have a heart attack. I pour a glass of water and gulp it down greedily. I try to rationalize. Maybe I moved Annie's doll myself and forgot. Some kind of alcohol blackout. I remember Brendan telling me how, in his drinking days, he suffered from hallucinations and memory loss. Once, he woke to find he had pushed a wardrobe down the stairs. He had no recollection of doing it, or any idea why. "Course, I was a lot bigger back then," he winked. "Alcohol weight." "Brendan, I think. I need to talk to Brendan." I try his number. It goes to voicemail. This isn't comforting, despite Gloria's assertion that he is fine. Gloria is not, I don't think, a liar. But it would be good to hear his voice, even if it is just telling me to feck off. It occurs to me that I have come to count on Brendan being around when I need him. His presence as familiar and comforting as an old pair of jeans, or my boogie shoes. Worry gnaws at my already ragged edges. I limp back into the living room. The folder is still open on the coffee table. I haven't finished it. Some pages I skimmed. But I'm done for tonight. I get the message. Arnhill is a grim little village where a lot of bad things have happened. Jinxed. Cursed. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. I start to pile the pages back into the folder. One of them catches my eye. It's another newspaper cutting. Tragic death of promising student. The picture, a smiling teenage girl, pretty with long dark hair and a glinting silver nose ring. Something about her smile reminds me of Annie. Despite myself, I scan the story. Emily Ryan, 13, a student at Arnhill Academy who killed herself with an overdose of alcohol and paracetamol. Described as bright, fun, and full of life. "You ever lost one?" Beth's voice pops into my head. The student she talked about, must be. But something about that is wrong. I sit down. It takes me a moment, my frazzled brain taking a while to haul itself up to speed. Finally, it clunks rustily into place. I couldn't tell you what day it is most of the time, but I could recite whole passages from Shakespeare, if you were very unlucky, and I really didn't like you. I can memorize reams of text and random words, just the way my mind works. I collect useless information like dust. 1 year, 1 day, and about 12 hours, 32 minutes. That's how long Beth said she had worked at Arnhill Academy, which would put her start date at September 2016. According to this story, Emily Ryan died on the 16th of March 2016. Of course, maybe Beth was wrong. Maybe she had her dates confused. But I don't think so. Oh, I'm counting. Which means that Beth wasn't a teacher here when Emily Ryan killed herself. Emily Ryan certainly wasn't one of her students. So why did she lie to me? 18. I wake early the next morning. This is uncalled for. I half open one eyelid, groan, and roll over. Annoyingly, my brain refuses to slip back into oblivion, even though the rest of my body feels like it has molded itself to the bed overnight. I lie there for several minutes, willing myself back to sleep. In the end, I give up, peel myself from the mattress and swing my legs out onto the cold floor. Coffee, my brain instructs, and nicotine. It's a grey, blustery day. The wind herding clouds across the sky, like a parent hurrying along recalcitrant children. I shiver and finish the cigarette quickly, eager to get back inside to the relative warmth of the cottage. Already the events of last night have become indistinct, blurred in my memory. I take Abby Eyes out of the cupboard. In daylight, she looks harmless, Just an old broken doll. A little worse for wear, a little unloved. You and me both, I think. I feel bad now about sticking her beneath the sink. So I take her through to the living room and place her on an armchair. I sit down on the sofa and finish my coffee. Abby Eyes and me, enjoying a little morning downtime. I try Brenda's number twice more. Still no reply. I read the newspaper article about Emily Ryan again. It makes no more sense this morning than it did last night. I try to distract myself by taking out a pile of marking. I get about halfway through before I realize I've just written "feck no" beside one particularly clunky paragraph and give up. I glance at my watch. It's 9:30 a.m. I have no real desire to hang around the cottage all day, and nothing else to occupy my time. There's nothing else for it. I decide to go for a walk. The first tentative excavations in Arnhill began some time back in the 18th century. The mine grew, expanded, was demolished, rebuilt and modernized over a period of 200 years. Thousands of men and families built their livelihoods around the mine. It wasn't a job. It was a way of life. If Arnhill was a living organism, then the mine was its beating, smoke-bellowing heart. When the mine closed, it took the council less than 2 years to rip out that heart, although by that time it had long stopped beating. Soot and smoke no longer circulated around its steel arteries. The buildings had crumbled and been vandalized. Thieves had stolen a lot of the metal, fixtures and fittings. In a way, it was a mercy when the bulldozers moved in. Finally, there was nothing left. Nothing except a deep wound in the land, a constant reminder of what had been lost. Some families moved to find work elsewhere. Others, like my dad, adapted. The village limped its way back to a sort of recovery, but some scars don't ever really heal. The rugged landscape rises in front of me, grown thick and abundant with wild flowers and grass. Hard to believe that once in this same place stood great industrial buildings, that beneath the earth there are still shafts and machinery abandoned because it was too costly to remove. But that's not all that lies beneath the earth. Before the mines, before the machines that bore into the ground, there were other excavations here, other traditions upon which this village was built. I start to ascend, glad I brought my stick to aid my progress along the uneven ground. I found a way in through a narrow gap in the perimeter fence. From the trampled down grass and bare earth the other side, I guess it is a well-used entrance. As a kid, I knew this place well. Now, it is foreign to me. I can't place exactly where I am or even where the old shafts used to be. And the hatch doesn't exist anymore. That was lost, along with our way in, thanks to Chris. For good, I thought. But I should have known. Some things won't stay buried, and kids will always find a way. I stand at the crest of one steep hill to catch my breath. Even if I didn't have a crippled leg, I'm not a man used to hiking and hill climbing. I'm built for sitting at tables and perching on bar stools. I have never even run for a bus. I try to force my lungs to drag in some much-needed oxygen, and then I give up, pull out my cigarettes and light one. I thought that when I got out here I would feel some instinctive recall, a twinge, like an internal divining rod. But there is nothing. The only twinge I'm feeling is from my bruised ribs. Perhaps I have worked too hard to forget. I'm not sure if that makes me disappointed or relieved. I stare around at the undulating lines of brown and green, scraggy grass and hard thorny bushes, slopes of slippery gravel, and deep hollows filled with muddy marsh water and swaying reeds. I can almost hear them whispering to me. You thought you could just stroll up here and find your way back? It doesn't work like that, Joey boy. Haven't you learned anything by now? You don't find me. I find you. And don't you fucking forget it.
I shiver a little. Perhaps this little hike up memory hill, like many of my actions, is a fruitless exercise. Perhaps the email isn't important either, or the text, or any of it. Maybe the best thing to do would be to get what I am due and get out. I'm not the hero type. I'm not the guy in the film who goes back, solves the mystery, and gets the girl. If anything, I'm the deadbeat friend who never makes it past the second act. What happened here was a long time ago. I've lived 25 years without having to revisit it. Why bother now? Because it's happening again. Who cares? It's not my problem. Not my battle. With any luck, the excavators will cause the whole rotten village to fall into the earth, and that really will be the end of it. I start to turn, but something catches my eye. Something fluttering on the ground. I stare at it for a moment. Then I crouch down and pick it up. A Wambar wrapper. I'd recognize that bright blue and red anywhere. Chris's pockets used to be stuffed with them. If he had made it to adulthood, I doubt his teeth would have done the same. I straighten and look down the hill. I'm sure it isn't steep enough. But still, I tuck the wrapper into my pocket and scramble down the slope. It's actually steeper than I gave it credit for at the top, and halfway down my bad leg gives, my feet slip out from under me, and I skid the remaining few yards on my backside. I lie at the bottom for a moment, winded and shaken. Getting vertical again seems like an effort. I close my eyes and take a few deep breaths.
You never called my mum.
I start and sit up. A young woman, her pale face framed by a hooded parka, stares down at me. She's holding a small, scruffy black dog on a lead. Something about her is familiar, and then it clicks. The charming barmaid from the pub. Lauren. If she notices that I'm lying prone, covered in dirt, it doesn't register on her face. I'm fine, I say. Thanks for asking.
Old bloke fell up here last year. Died of hypothermia.
Oh, thank God a good Samaritan like you found me. I grab my stick and force myself clumsily to my feet. The dog sniffs around my boots. I like dogs. They're uncomplicated. Easy. Unlike people. Or cats. I reach to tuck him under the chin. His lips draw back and he snarls. I snatch my hand back.
He doesn't like being stroked,
Lauren says. Right. There's a patch of missing fur, almost like a ring, around his neck. An old scar. What happened to him?
He got caught on some barbed wire, slit his throat open.
Amazing he survived. I shrug. Is he your dog?
No, Mum's. She's had him for years.
You walk him up here a lot?
I suppose.
Many other people walk up here?
A few.
The words blood and stone come to mind. I hear some of the kids from school hang around here too.
Some of them.
When I was a kid, we used to do that. We'd look for ways into the old shafts.
Must have been a long time ago.
It was. Thanks for rubbing it in. She doesn't smile.
Why haven't you called Mum?
I don't need a cleaner right now. Sorry.
Okay.
She turns to go. I realize I'm missing an opportunity. Wait. She looks back. Your mum, she cleaned the cottage for Mrs. Morton?
Yeah.
So she knew her?
Not really.
But she must have spoken to her.
Mrs. Morton kept herself to herself.
Your mum never mentioned Mrs. Morton acting oddly, seeming upset, disturbed? A shrug. I heard Ben went missing. You think he ran away? Another shrug. I try one last time. Was Ben one of the kids who came up here? Did they find something? Maybe a tunnel, a cave? You should call Mum. I told you I don't... Then I catch myself. If I call your mum, will she talk to me? She stares at me.
She charges £10 an hour, £50 for a deep clean.
I get the drift. Right, I'll bear it in mind. The dog edges towards my boots again. Lauren gives it a little tug on the lead. It wrinkles its grey muzzle at her. It must be pretty old, I say.
Mum says he should be dead.
I'm sure she doesn't mean it.
Yeah, she does.
She turns.
I have to go.
See you then. I call after her. She doesn't return the farewell, but as she walks away, I hear her murmur almost to herself,
"You're in the wrong place."
Weird. Doesn't really cover it. A white van is parked outside the cottage when I get back. There's a picture of a large tap on the back. I make a wild guess that it belongs to a plumber. Bearing in mind my current bathroom issues, this would be fortuitous, if I had called the plumber. As I draw closer, my worst fears are confirmed. The name on the side reads, Fletcher and Sons Plumbing and Heating. I watch as the doors swing open. Unwise hair climbs out of one side. Another figure, less familiar these days, climbs out of the driver's side. He spits yellow phlegm on the ground.
Thorny, fuck me. Never thought I'd see you back here.
I can't say the same. I always knew Fletch would never leave. Some kids, you just do. It's not that they don't want to move somewhere else. It's just that the thought that there is somewhere else has never even occurred to them. What can I say? I hold out my arms. I missed the warm welcome. Fletch looks me up and down.
You've not changed.
Again, I can't say the same. If the years have not been kind to any of us, they've been really hard on Nick Fletcher. Always a blunt-faced youth, one of those kids who probably looked old even in nappies, he has lost the sinewy muscle that once made him such a formidable bouncer for Hurst. Now, he's thin to the point of skeletal. His shorn hair is a dirty nicotine yellow, and his face is criss-crossed with deep creases that only illness or a lifetime of drinking and smoking can carve. He walks up to me, unwise hair lurking behind in a way that I presume is supposed to be menacing, but just makes him look a bit constipated. I note the swollen look of his nose and bruises beneath both eyes. Gloria. I wonder if his brother is still nursing his injured shoulder. I feel a sliver of satisfaction. Fletch himself has the gait of a man, not dissimilar to me, battling some kind of pain or stiffness in his joints. Arthritis, maybe. The malformed knuckles of his hands are a further giveaway. I guess pounding heads takes its toll after a while. As he draws nearer, I can smell him. Juicy fruit and cigarettes. All Fletch ever smelled of was juicy fruit and cigarettes. Perhaps he hasn't changed that much.
You're not wanted here, Thorny. Why don't you do everyone a favour and fuck off back to whatever shitty stone you crawled out from?
Wow. That was a long sentence for you. A bit clichéd, a slight mix of adjectives and verbs, but not bad. His face darkens. Unwise hair lumbers forward. I can sense the barely contained violence. He's not just ready to beat the crap out of me. He's eager for it, slavering like a dog eyeing a juicy bone.
Like father, like son.
Fletch always preferred to punch first and ask questions later. He didn't need an excuse to hurt someone, but Hurst helpfully gave him one. Fletch enjoyed smashing teeth and blacking eyes. He was a mean and dirty little fighter, and he didn't give in. I'd seen him take on bigger lads than himself and wear them down with sheer viciousness and persistence. If Hurst hadn't held his leash, I think even then he could have easily beaten someone to death. He holds up one misshapen hand to his son, who stumbles to a halt.
What do you want?
World peace, fair wages for all, a better future for our children.
Still think you're funny?
Someone has to. The hand wavers. I want to see Hurst, I say quickly. I think we can come to an arrangement that will suit both of us.
Really?
I have something he wants. I'm happy to give it to him. For a price. He snorts.
You know Hurst said to take it easy on you the other night. Maybe he's not feeling so generous now you're threatening him.
I'm willing to take the gamble.
Then you're more fucking stupid than you look.
Really? Because it looks to me like your son took a pretty good beating last night too. I smile at Unwise's hair. How's your brother's shoulder? His face reddens.
You got lucky, cripple.
Yeah, Fletch says. No big mates around to help you now.
Big mates? So his sons couldn't admit to being beaten up by a woman.
And no one fucks with my lads,
Fletch snarls. He lowers his hand. Unwise hair lunges. But this time I'm prepared. As he raises a fist, I swing the stick. It catches him hard above his ear, and he drops to the ground. I jab the stick into his stomach, then smash it across his back. He folds like a particularly ugly piece of origami. Fletch starts towards me, but he is older and slower than his son. I sidestep and bring the stick up between his legs. He yelps and crumples to his knees. I've picked up a few hints on causing pain myself over the years. I lean over him, panting slightly.
You were wrong, I say. I have changed.
He squints up at me, eyes full of tears.
You are so fucking dead,
says the man, clutching his balls. Now you tell Hurst I want a meeting. He can choose the night, but it has to be this week.
You have no idea what you're getting yourself into.
Unwise's hair starts to rise. He looks dazed and is younger than I first assumed. I feel a twinge of guilt. But only a twinge. I swing the stick and smash it across his swollen nose. Blood spurts out. He screams and clutches at his face. No, you have no idea what I'm getting myself out of. You've got 5 minutes to get out of here, or I call the police. I turn and stagger towards the cottage. Now the adrenaline is fading. My battered body is complaining loudly at my exertions. Fletch shouts after me.
Your sister's dead. You can't bring her back.
The sentence hangs. He doesn't finish it. He doesn't need to.
1992. We had agreed to meet back at the pit at 9 p.m. No one went up there that late, and we didn't want anyone to catch us and ask us what we were doing. I planned to sneak out sometime after dinner. Mum was busy with a pile of ironing, and Dad would be down the pub. There was just something I needed to do first. I crept out of the kitchen door and over to the shed in the backyard. It was where Dad kept his tools and his old mining equipment. I had to delve a bit, brushing aside cobwebs and dead spiders. Then I found it. An old work jacket, sturdy boots, rope, a torch, and, yes, a miner's helmet. I picked it up, wiped off some dirt and fiddled with the light at the front. I half expected it not to work, but, to my surprise, a robust yellow beam flared out.
What are you doing?
I jumped and spun around, almost dropping the helmet.
Shit! What are you doing sneaking up on me?
Annie stood in the doorway, skinny silhouette framed by the fading evening light.
She was dressed in her pajamas, pink, with a picture of a Care Bear on.